Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. An 11-year-old Michigan boy took his own life in March, allegedly after falling for a cyber prank that claimed that his girlfriend had killed herself. The case remains under investigation, but the 13-year-old girl involved has been charged with malicious use of telecommunication services and using a computer to commit a crime. Though suicide can rarely be attributed to a single cause, it's clear that cyberbullying is a problem in our culture and that it can have tragic consequences. Joining us now is syndicated tech columnist and CEO of ConnectSafely.org, Larry Magid. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Before we continue our conversation, listeners, if you or someone you know is showing signs, warning signs of suicide, consider contacting the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. 1-800-273-TALK. What do we know about how common cyberbullying is now? It seems like we talk about it routinely, at least on this show. You hear about it all over the place. But is it a growing issue or what?
Well, first of all, it depends on how you define cyberbullying.
Yeah.
So there is a traditional kind of academic definition of bullying, and cyberbullying is bullying, which is it has to be repeated, it has to have a power differential, and it has to be aggressive or severe. So by that definition, cyberbullying actually, A, is not growing, and B, is not pervasive. There are a number of studies that range from as little as 1 or 2% of teens. Some claim 85% of teens, but the national Cyberbullying Research Center, they think that the average is around about 20%. In other words, 20% of teens have engaged in it, and about 20% of teens have been affected by it directly. I don't like to use the word victim and bully, but you could argue 20% have been bullies and 20% have been bullied. But those are approximate numbers based on a variety of studies. So whether you want to call it an epidemic or not, I wouldn't use that term.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I would argue that exaggerating the prevalence of it can be dangerous because it tends to make it look like it's normal, and it is not normal. Most kids do not bully. Most kids are not bullied, and it's very, very important to get that message out there for anybody who thinks it's normal, cool, age-appropriate, or anything of the like to bully other people. Now, having said that, then there are various degrees of things that we do online that could be jokes, that could be minor digs, that could be inside jokes, and then probably the numbers are much higher, but in terms of what we would normally call bullying. And of course, even in this case, I agree that it's cyberbullying, but clearly, but there would be those who would argue, had it not been a tragic consequence, that it was just kind of a joke that you know, which in
this case
went very, very wrong.
I guess, you know, I'm not saying it isn't tragic. I'm not saying it's right. But it seems there's a distinction between prank and an immature prank and a bullying situation.
There can be. I mean, who hasn't played a joke on a friend? I mean,
we
dedicate an entire day to it every year, April Fool's Day,
mm-hmm.
Where we say things and we most of the time it's kind of just a laugh. But in this case, because of the nature of what this person did, because she said something that obviously would throw a person into a deep depression or, you know, anxiety. To be told that somebody you're very close to had died, you know, would throw anybody. And that's one of those things we don't joke about, right? You and I know that. Adults
mm-hmm.
don't make those kinds of jokes. But this was an immature child who apparently didn't – again, I don't know anything about the case.
Yeah.
Either the girl who was accused of it or the child who took his own life. But this was kind of a – you know, something where I suppose it's a child who committed this crime, if it's being prosecuted, I'm guessing probably had no idea that this was a possible consequence of this kind of prank.
You mentioned on your website that avoiding the term cyberbullying when you're having conversations with your kids about this might be wise. Why does the lexicon matter?
Well, there's a lot of issues in terms of lexicon. One issue is to remember we're talking children. Whether the person is engaged in bullying behavior or whether the person is affected by it, either in terms of being directly bullied or a bystander, they're still children. And we don't want to criminalize adolescent or pre-adolescent behavior. We want to use it as a teaching lesson and try to get young people to kind of move on as they get older and be treat each other more nicely, that's the term I was about to use, and which is why a lot of the anti-bullying people are now emphasizing social emotional learning at a very young age to try to teach empathy and understanding and putting yourself in someone else's shoes, et cetera. And I think had that girl thought about it in those terms, how would I feel if I were told that somebody very close to me had died? I mean, I think had that thought gone into her mind, perhaps she wouldn't have made this post. And so those are some of the texts. But using words like bullying, cyberbullying, it doesn't help a lot. I mean, I think it helps adults. I think, though, that for kids, it is important to talk about behavior. And as much as this particular story is, first of all, very, very unusual, you know, we have to also remember that right. As tragic as these instances are, and it's of course horrible, they're rare. It's not common that children who are bullied take their own life. The children are bullied every day, and the reaction range is from extremely severe like this, which is very rare, to no big deal, which is also relatively rare. But it's generally not nearly as severe as this, obviously. So we need to keep that in mind, not that that's any solace to the family of the victim, of course, but we also need to realize that these are children and that we need to be talking about what is going to make them better people, better adults, and also more resilient, able to handle the things that we all have to deal with in life. Look, every once in a while something comes to my mind that's depressing, that's sad, and puts me into a little bit of a tailspin, like most people, but learning how to kind of process that and handle it is another very, very important thing about growing up.
And these are all conversations you should be having with your kid anyway.
Right. I mean, I remember having it long before we had the term cyberbullying within our vocabulary with my daughter when she'd be very, very upset because something happened. And I sat down with her and said, I know this is a really depressing moment, but I guarantee you a year from now, you won't even remember this, but you'll be dealing with some other sad situation because we deal with them all the time in life, and the trick is to kind of process them and try to get through them.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the topic of cyberbullying, what it means, and what kind of steps you can take to maybe lessen the pressure on your kids on either side of the coin, whether they're the bully or the one being bullied or something in between. We were spurred to this conversation by the recent case of the child in Marquette, Michigan, who took his own life, 11-year-old, after he was pranked into thinking that his girlfriend had committed suicide. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. I'm talking to syndicated tech columnist and CEO of ConnectSafely.org. So if you have a question or comment for Larry Magid, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. The tech tools are changing too, right, Larry? I mean,
yeah.
In this case, I think it was involved the messaging app Snapchat, which disappears. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not like a parent can go on Snapchat and see what their kids have been posting.
Right. Snapchat does disappear, and it's important to put these things into context. One could say, oh, that's a horrible situation because Snapchat disappears and nobody's held accountable for their actions. But on the other hand, it also allows kids to be kids. They can be a little goofy. There's no, quote, permanent record of their behavior as there is on Facebook that you have to then go back and prune later and curate to make sure that it's not hanging around when your college admissions officers might be looking at your page. So there's a lot of positives about this kind of disappearing. Obviously, there's a reason why it's so popular. And having written a parent's guide to Snapchat, which you can find at ConnectSafely.org, along with guides to Instagram and Kick and actually, the Kick one's not there yet, but After School and other apps. I mean, what we found is that there's a lot of positive uses, even anonymity. People are very, very upset about, oh, my God, you can be anonymous. Well, anonymity is what allows people to express their doubts about their sexuality or their gender identity or their religion or their politics without having to face consequences, without being outed, so to speak. It allows dissidents to engage in various activities, whistleblower, if you name it. So the anonymity isn't necessarily bad either. So we have to put all of these kind of negatives that we perceive to put these apps into context. But at the same time, every device, every tool that's powerful has potential danger. So, you know, matches are great, but if you misuse them, you cause fires. And I think that is true with whether it's Snapchat or Facebook or texting or Instagram or Kick or after school, Yik Yak, you name it, there are going to be potential abuses. And what's important is not so much the focus on the app, but the focus on the behavior. So, for example, what this girl allegedly did would have been inappropriate regardless of the technology. It would have been inappropriate if she called them on the phone and said that. It would have been inappropriate if she said it at school. Mm-hmm. It would have been inappropriate if she'd written them a letter and said that. It's not the technology that caused the problem. It's the fact that she said something that is she told a joke, I guess, that is the kind of joke one should never tell because of the impact it has on people.
Wendy in Columbus, you're on the air with Larry Maggott. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, and quick question for you. I got a little bit of concern with your guest. I think that children really need to understand that they are bullying, whether it's a joke or not, because if we kind of sweep that under the carpet and say it's childish behavior, no matter if it was a joke or not, it seems to enable children to continue to do this, whether it's cyber or on the phone or texting, that sort of thing. So I'm going to disagree with you just a bit. I think that it is proper for parents and for us as a society to say this is not okay, whether it's a joke or not. And I'll take my comment.
I never said it was okay.
Yeah, I know.
I completely agree with you. I don't see any conflict between what the caller just said mm-hmm. and what we talk about on Connect Safely. Absolutely. You need to work with your child. I'll give you a perfect example. My son, who is now a young adult, and I must say one who I am very proud of, when he was in middle school, came home and talked about things being gay, about, oh, he's so gay. And I said, Will, you know, what are you talking about? We have family members who are gay. And he had really, he kind of understood the term gay. He knew what it meant. But he didn't make the connection between making that comment and making a statement that could be very offensive to somebody who is gay or is questioning their sexuality. And so he was bullying someone and didn't even know it. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was in college a long time ago, my roommate said to me, oh, I was Jewed out of some money. And I said, Rick, you know I'm Jewish. I mean, even if I weren't Jewish, that's a horribly offensive statement to make. And he said, oh, I'm sorry, I never made the connection. I mean, it was hard for me to believe, right? But he never realized that he was making a religious ethnic slur. It was just part of his vocabulary. The other term, gypped, is a derogatory term. So there's so much that we just need to teach our kids. But beyond that, often kids do realize they're being mean, or they can be made to realize they're being mean. So I would agree with the caller, and I, frankly, if you want to call it bullying, fine. I don't think that's a big deal, but have the conversation with your kids, both preemptively before an issue comes up, and reactively if you suspect any issues are coming up.
This has been kind of a conversation that's not necessarily tech related, as you've made, you know, right, the salient point of, Larry Maggott. But technology, so you're saying that bullying's always been around. Technology hasn't necessarily proliferated it, or it just seems like
it's
we're talking about it.
It.
It's amplified it. Okay, difference.
Yeah,
yes,
it's
but important.
So and also it's made it, it. First of all, it's also made it so that the perpetrators can be different. So when I was a kid, the bully was that big, tough kid who was bigger than me, and the power imbalance was that he's bigger than me. Now, so in this case, it was a girl who perpetuated against a boy, and it happened to be she was older, but it could have been the other way around. Mm-hmm. I mean, she had the power by virtue of her access to the app that the guy who beat me up in middle school had by virtue of his muscles. So power relationships are different. And the impact, one of the things that really bothers me about cyberbullying, if I come up to you and I call you a name, you and I are in the same room at the same time, and if you have a severe emotional reaction and I have an ounce of decency in me, I can say, oh, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't really mean to do that to you. If I cyberbully you online, I'm not there. I can't even see how you're reacting. What I might have thought was a joke or kind of a minor slur could put you into a tailspin, and I wouldn't even know it. So even people who have some empathy may not be able to exercise that empathy because they're not with the person who's being affected. And you know, there's a million examples of how cyberbullying is both the same and different than physical bullying, and it's also the fact it can be repeated, and you don't necessarily know who the perpetrator is, mm-hmm. and you might not even know who the victim is. I could make a slur online that could affect somebody who I don't even know.
And it can be shared with lots of people you don't know.
Absolutely, and it can be spread, which, of course, is one of the main things we talk about. Is don't share it, don't spread it, be an upstander, not a bystander, interrupt, and try to be positive if you encounter it. And that's the good thing about cyberbullying. Is there, maybe not in this case, but often there are witnesses, and often there is some kind of a record.
Larry Maggott, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Larry Maggott, he's syndicated tech columnist and CEO of ConnectSafely.org. We'll put a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 2 billion people from around the world use Facebook every month, making the social media network a major part of the world's information diet. It's a diet that increasingly includes fake news, and Facebook has been criticized for letting that material spread unchecked and creating an information bubble for its users. Facebook has worked to address some of those concerns, but some believe that without any viable competition, the social media giant has little incentive to do so. Editor-at-large at MIT Technology Review, Brian Bergstein, recently wrote about this issue in a piece called "We Need More Alternatives to Facebook." We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. He joins us now. Brian Bergstein, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, you kind of compared this to something that really resonates for me because I'm so old, and I remember back when there were just 3 channels on the TV, and you were sort of stuck watching what you were ever stuck. You know, you still thought about what you watched, but it was only 3 things. And now, you know, there's just a plethora, and you're saying the golden age of television, which we have talked about on this show, is a thing because of competition.
Right. So my piece was actually inspired by you could call it a manifesto or a letter to the community, whatever you want to call it, that Mark Zuckerberg himself wrote in February. And it talked about how, you know, understandably, all the things that he feels that Facebook is great at, but it talked about things he wanted to improve about Facebook. And he said that among the things he wanted to do were to sort of strengthen community ties, help people become more engaged in democracy, and more aware of information about their world. And he also said he would do more to kind of stamp out or not stamp out, but to help people recognize that some stories that are purporting to be news are actually complete hoaxes. So what was interesting to me about Zuckerberg's letter is that he was, I think, very well-intentioned. But it was a moment where he paused and said, you know, are we building the world that we all want? And what was interesting to me was that at past moments in history where a communications medium is sort of, you know, taken stock of, the solution has sort of naturally been we need more competition. So in my piece, I draw the comparison to the what you mentioned, the era of, you know, the 3 main broadcast networks. And in 1961, Newton Minow, the chairman of the FCC, sort of took on the broadcast industry and said, you know, much of what you produce is a vast wasteland. And he said, basically, TV is a medium with so much promise, but what we need is more competition. And I just thought that in reading Zuckerberg's manifesto, he was sort of leaving out, you know, understandably, the potential role that more competition plays in creating a healthier information ecosystem. So Zuckerberg very much wants everyone to spend as much time on Facebook as possible. And I'm saying actually that no matter how well-intentioned he is, a slightly better Facebook isn't going to solve the problems he himself is acknowledging. And what we need are more avenues that we all go to do the things we do on Facebook.
A big difference, though, in that comparison is that with TV, a technological change brought about the proliferation of competition, that being cable. And now the internet and so on and so forth and everything else we're dealing with. But what would that be? What would spur the competition in the case of Facebook?
Yeah, obviously the analogy or the comparison only goes so far. I mean, after all,
I think it's a good comparison, but it makes you wonder.
Well, right. So here's what I would say to that is there's limitless competition in one sense online. I mean, there's no barrier to entry for anybody to kind of publish whatever they want. The difference, though, with the TV example, it was not only were there new technologies that made it possible for people to, have more choice. There was also a conscious decision in the 1960s to, as I imagine is dear to your heart and probably those of your listeners, there was a conscious decision to support nonprofit media as well.
Oh, yeah.
So the rise of public broadcasting kind of comes, there was some non-commercial public or educational TV before Minow's speech in 1961, mm-hmm. but it was throughout the 60s that some private foundations stepped up. And, we ended up with a media, a broadcast TV and radio ecosystem that now includes NPR and PBS. So the variety that we got was not entirely technological. It was also business model innovation. And so I think the comparison that could be made now is it's a little bit of a thought experiment, I'm guessing. But what if we had non-commercial or publicly supported social media? And it's a way to kind of that question, I think, helps us think about what social media is and what we want it to be.
Facebook has had competition from other social media services, not exactly like Facebook, but none have seemed to reach the appeal of Facebook. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I've heard for years that the younger generation doesn't even use Facebook. They hate Facebook. They gravitate to Instagram and Snapchat. Facebook, went out and bought Instagram to kind of help hedge against that problem. Facebook, unlike the other social media sites, really wants to be all things to all people. And that's what I'm arguing in my piece is a little bit of a mismatch. Facebook is great at helping us stay in touch with long-lost friends or distant relatives or even people that you meet and finding groups. It has so many great qualities. But Zuckerberg, in his piece, was sort of in his manifesto, was arguing that we need Facebook to become an even bigger part of your life if we're going to build the world we want to build. And I think that we would probably be better off as a society not sort of putting all of our eggs in the Facebook basket and acknowledging that we need other things to try to do some of the things Facebook does. So Snapchat does some of that. Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, they all do aspects of it, but Facebook is used by 68% of American adults. Those other services are used by around 20% each. So Facebook has this really enormous role in our society. And given the fact that Facebook builds its business is built on harvesting your personal information so that it can sell ads against it, there's both a social good maybe not being fully realized by everybody kind of only doing Facebook for Facebook things. And there's a potential, privacy cost that we don't have a chance to really, weigh whether if there was a non-commercial alternative to Facebook, maybe people would want that because they wouldn't have to be given up so much of their personal information that you do on Facebook.
For a long time, public television was fine, but it wasn't the same class as commercial television. It wasn't. Now that's changed a lot. I mean, obviously, we know one of the biggest record-breaking, long-term programs of all time was on PBS, Downton Abbey, incredibly produced. But there was a learning curve for public TV to get up to speed. And at the speed at which we operate with technology these days, you just wonder, is there any way to catch up?
Right, and again, this is where the parallel to broadcasting breaks down a little bit because, Facebook isn't producing the content It has, I think, some responsibility for the content that gets disseminated, but it's not the creator of the content.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it's the creator of the experience.
Right, but that's an advantage, though, for any would-be upstart, in that the barrier to entry is not, oh, I have to produce all this stuff that people want. There's great stuff on the internet that you could facilitate connections to, you know, instantly.
Mm-hmm.
So the barrier to entry is Facebook, is the network effects. You know, everybody's on Facebook, so everybody joins Facebook because that's okay. Where everybody is, and
yeah.
So on. And it could be that Facebook stays a huge part of our lives, but we don't use it for everything. So Zuckerberg said, you know, it started primarily as a social site, and now it's become also a place that shapes your understanding of the news and public discourse. And that's what I'm trying to get at, which mm-hmm. is that maybe we need something else for the news and public discourse part, and let's let Facebook be the great social network that it is. That's its name, right, is the social network, and not try to mix our understanding of the world with an engine that is primarily designed to keep you socializing.
You referred to the idea of niche social networks. You know, one place you go for your politics, another place you go, well, you know, there's Pinterest, you know, that people go for all kinds of stuff. And, you know, that kind of a thing. It'll be niched out.
I mean, that's an alternative version of the future, right? I mean, one version is that Facebook just becomes, you know, takes more and more of our online life and more of our online time. And if that's what people want, you know what? But I just feel like it's a good time to take to stop and ask ourselves, do we want Facebook to equal the internet at some point? You know, does it just subsume more and more and more of what we do online? Or, you know, do you go to maybe Twitter or LinkedIn for some things, or sites yet to be born for other things? And I think it's okay. You know, the internet is so vast. I think it would be a mistake for us to just sort of say, well, I'm okay to have Facebook shape our experience of more and more of that.
Some attempts at Facebook alternatives have struggled. Diaspora, Parleo, I hadn't heard of that before. Can you tell us a little bit about them and what worked and what didn't?
Yeah, it's funny. Just since my piece came out yesterday, people have pointed out to me some other alternatives that are, there's something called Mastodon that just was created. It's sort of more like Twitter than Facebook,
uh-huh.
So with longer posts. There's something called Minds. That's something just people just wrote me about. Parleo is a really interesting example. It was co-founded by one of the leading figures in the Arab Spring in Egypt to truly create, you know, a well thought out social media experience where really only thoughtful posts, you know, got the most airtime. And it's now part of Quora, which is a question and answer site that actually I learn a lot from. You know, it's tricky. I don't have the answer to say that the alternative that will stick and please people and do some of what we're not getting from Facebook. You know, it's hard to know what that will do right that some of these other sites haven't done right. Typically, some of these other sites like Diaspora or some of the other ones, maybe they're a little bit harder to use for someone who's sort of more of a novice.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of it. But, you know, it's kind of like you never know what mom and pop shop will blossom to be, you know, a chain someday, right? And
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a similar thing.
Google Plus, far from a mom and pop shop, but they tried their, you know, Google, you know, tried to establish a social network with Google Plus. That failed to catch on to, it was just a hassle, I thought, but maybe, I don't know, maybe it's because I was already on Facebook, right?
Well, so that's interesting, very interesting example, because what company has, you know, more resources than Google?
Exactly.
To throw, and it was actually an attempt to kind of take power away from Facebook. You know, so that was, that's a cautionary tale. There's no doubt about it. You know, it just didn't quite, Google has struggled to figure out what it brings to social that's new. You know, there've been even before Google Plus, there were some other early attempts that Google made. So yeah, that's a cautionary tale. But again, Google is, a company that needs to make money and maybe doesn't have as much patience as a nonprofit might. It might not be able to take some risks that a nonprofit alternative might want to take.
What kind of, you said you did have get some response from people with ideas of other social networks that have are out there, but what other kind of reaction have you gotten to this?
Mostly positive, I'm grateful to say. I think people are aware that Facebook is this really big presence in our online experience, and we kind of don't know what to do about it. And it's maybe hard to, Zuckerberg does seem to be very well intentioned with the ways he wants to, you know, to improve Facebook. He said in his February letter, "Are we building the world we all want?" And I think there's a little bit of, even among people who use Facebook, who say, you know, what is it doing to my life or my experience online to be on Facebook so much? So I think there's probably a moment where we're wondering, you know, there's very much this winner take all dynamic in a lot of tech categories, and you know, I think there's a willingness or an interest in questioning, you know, is Facebook going to be sort of unchallenged. I've heard people say for a while that Facebook should be regulated like a communications utility. Hmm. And I don't know that, to me that seems hard to envision. It seems messy. It seems fraught in so many ways, both political and logistical. But you know, imagining other competitors to Facebook might at least change the way regulators respond the next time Facebook wants to buy a rival social network. Hmm. You know, if today it tried to buy Instagram, would that sail through? Or, you know, regulators in Europe are looking very closely at Facebook.
They're much more particular about that stuff.
Yeah, and especially about privacy considerations.
Right.
Because Facebook sits on so much data and controls, you know, an advertising network. It's a very powerful company. So I think I've been interested to see how many different ways people are coming at questioning Facebook's power, just like you would question any really big company's power.
Brian Bergstein, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Bergstein, editor-at-large at MIT Technology Review, will post a link to his article about is Facebook too big or should there be competition for Facebook on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Tech companies such as Facebook and Google have been criticized for not doing enough to curb the spread of false or inaccurate information, in other words, fake news. The industry is responding to these concerns, and most recently, Google has turned to third-party fact-checkers and posting their reviews of what has been identified as fake news. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor to AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what's Google doing now?
Well, so this is one in several steps that are being taken to kind of make it so that things that show up in the search results through kind of natural algorithm stuff, you know, are not just this wildly inaccurate stuff that we share because it has a particularly salacious headline. And in this case, what they're doing is anything that shows up in the top of your search results in kind of that little card that you see at the top, or in the top bar of the Google News feed will have a separate modifier at the bottom, a link at the bottom of that card that will say whether or not the information in that article has been disproven by, more common fact-checking sources.
Are they posting it in a way that is easily obvious? I mean, is it obvious? That's kind of redundant. Is it obvious that this is going on?
It's pretty obvious. You know, you do kind of have to look for it a little bit. The text is a little smaller than, say, the text of the headline that you would see in the card. But it's still within the contents of the card, and it's one of the only parts that are, you know, is blue text. because it links directly to the, you know, the source that is claiming that you know, the information has been disproven. So there's some flexibility there as far as whether or not you'll actually notice it. But as we've seen with a lot of stuff in Google's past, when they make kind of these small modifications, it becomes really quickly a part of how people expect to experience the Google search results, such that when it's missing, you almost start to feel like something's wrong.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're using third party. They're using fact checkers that are already out there, right? They're not contracting with somebody. Is that correct?
Right. Google's not trying to become their own fact checker, which is an important position for Google's kind of continued stance on really not taking a stance.
Yeah.
When it comes to a lot of the topics that are out there. So they're working with many different sources. You know, the more common things that you would find through Snopes and through they're not partnered yet with the Washington Post, but anyone that is working right now to kind of collect and you know, act as a fact checking medium, you know, where you can go and specifically look up for whether something is true or false, will eventually be able to work within this system with Google. And the whole point is to be able to provide multiple sources, you know, either for when, you know, there's kind of a consensus that something is, you know, just completely false, or if there are, you know, kind of multiple sides, so that people can read both, you know, multiple sides and form their own opinion.
Is this automatically going to happen? Is it an algorithm, or is there somebody flagging on stuff to do this?
You know, typically what we see with Google stuff is, you know, there's a fair bit of automation that happens.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, someone from Google will reach in, you know, and kind of highlight something as being, you know, important in an attempt to kind of, you know, add more information to the algorithm so that eventually it does run automatically.
Okay. And why is it tough for Google or social media sites like Facebook or whatever to do this? Why is fact checking so difficult for them?
Well, it winds up really just kind of being shades of gray, and this is a problem that Google has caught a lot of flack for recently on a number of different topics, the most recent being, you know, climate change, where if you searched recently for information on the Great Barrier Reef and, you know, some of the things that are happening to the Great Barrier Reef, one of the top stories that would show up was an article from Breitbart essentially attacking you know, any scientist that had legitimate, you know, information on you know, what was happening to the Great Barrier Reef.
Which is being bleached out right now, right.
Yeah. Right, which is being bleached out. And so that was, you know, that was, you know, a really contentious position for Google to find itself in because, you know, that the algorithm dictated that there was a fair number of people sharing this, you know, this other article. So, you know, as far as the computer was concerned, it must also be important. But to find the information inside of it, you know, so factually inaccurate, you know, caused a lot of problems, especially considering it was one of the first three things that you see or saw.
Right.
When you searched for that information.
You know, some of these fake news perpetrators are clever. They've made a lot of money doing it. So there's a lot at stake now. It's not just a joke or a prank. What is your sense about whether they will start posing as fact checkers? Can they beat the system, or is Google, you know, being careful about that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what will happen next, is we will see a rise in, you know, other organizations claiming to be fact checkers that are, you know, intentionally distributing things as falsehoods and kind of then acting as authorities to give kind of an alternative link to share as evidence of something. But it's going to be on Google really to either choose to omit those sources or continue to allow them. And I think that that's going to be something that we will see unfold here over the next year in particular.
Let's turn to Comcast, the gigantic cable and internet provider. It's stepping into the cellular service business. The new cell phone service is called Xfinity Mobile. What do they bring into the table here? Nothing much, or they can just afford to dip in and fiddle around?
Yeah, I think that this is one of those really cool things that happens when there's no regulatory body anymore. in that you can, you know, Comcast is you know, partnering with Verizon Wireless. Basically, they're buying service from Verizon Wireless, and they're adding it to their Wi-Fi calling service that they've had for a while now, where if you were a Comcast customer and you had a cell phone, then when you were connected to a Comcast Wi-Fi hotspot, then you didn't pay for data, you know, even if it wasn't in your home. And so they're combining these two features so that when you are out somewhere and there's a Comcast connection, you are automatically connected to it, similar to how Google's Project Fi works. And when you are off of a Wi-Fi connection, then you're using Verizon's, you know, wireless service, the same as it would be if you were in a Verizon store and had paid them for the service. And so you get this combination service that will, you know, kind of work with both. And the idea here is that you get this kind of moderately discounted rate for having Xfinity Mobile on top of the, you know, Xfinity television service at home.
Right. It's only for Comcast customers, right? You can't just get this on the side.
Yeah, the whole deal here is to, you know, for Comcast to offer a way for people to have, you know, just everything that has to do with your entertainment on a single bill, for better or worse.
They're calling it unlimited data. Is it really unlimited? I mean, what's it going to cost, and how do you define that nowadays?
It's the same kind of shaky unlimited that Verizon and T-Mobile right. and AT&T are using right now.
Yeah.
Where you have, in this case, it's 20 gigabytes of, you know, unlimited high-speed internet where the you know, your performance is expected to be at a very high rate for that first 20 gigabytes. And then after that 20 gigabytes, you know, Comcast has the ability to throttle you down to a slower speed, which, you know, in cases where services being purchased from another company, that happens a lot more than it does if you were just buying directly from the origin company. And it's worth pointing out that Verizon's own, you know, kind of quote unquote unlimited service has a much higher threshold, that data cap than the 20 gigabytes that Comcast is currently offering.
Well, how is it going to work? You said they're buying part of it from Verizon, or they're tapping into Verizon's service. How does that work? They're competitors, aren't they?
Yeah, it is. They are. But it's a service. It's not an uncommon service called a mobile virtual network operator. And it's something that we see in a couple of places in the United States, not usually for, you know, larger companies like this. But I think that this is really just a way for Comcast to kind of test the water and see how many of their customers are interested before they look at things like buying their own, you know, spectrum to create their own version of a network that would compete directly with AT&T and T-Mobile and Verizon.
And is this going to be a good deal for Comcast customers, or is this intended to attract new customers to Comcast? What are you expecting that way?
It has the potential to be worth it to Comcast customers who are looking for kind of a budget connection, because on top of the there's kind of a monthly plan where you can pay, you know, $45 a month and have access to this, you know, 20 gigs of unlimited data. But there's also a feature where you can purchase you know, single gigabytes at a time to use, which could be valuable for people who know that they only use 1 or 2 gigabytes. So they end up only paying $12 a month, you know, for that service. So it ends up being significantly cheaper on top of what they're paying for Comcast. And that could end up being really useful to customers who are looking to save. But as a competitive service versus, you know, Verizon and T-Mobile, it's definitely not going to be the kind of, you know, saving that you would consider moving immediately over to Comcast for all of your entertainment, just to save the $5 or $6 that you would end up saving depending on your bill.
Okay. You got an early look at the latest 360-degree camera from Samsung. It's called the Samsung Gear 360. It has a new shape. Okay, it's not on a phone, number one. It's a separate camera. What does it look like? Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is a weird thing to get excited about when I say something like, oh, they changed the shape of this thing. You know, but so the original Samsung Gear 360 was this kind of tennis ball shaped camera that had lenses on either side. And you could either, you know, have this little tripod that was connected to it, or you could, you know, mount it onto a bike helmet or something like that and capture the 360 degree image around you. The problem was that it was large enough that those two cameras were kind of far apart. And so when it, you know, went to stitch those two pictures together to create the sphere that you would see when you went to look into it, there was kind of the seam that went all the way around as these two halves were kind of haphazardly glued together through software. And so this new design is much more like a wand almost, and the sensors are now much closer together. The camera quality is still very similar to what you would have gotten from the original Samsung Gear 360, but it's easier to hold, it's easier to use, it's noticeably lighter, and has a big friendly button on the side for taking pictures instead of kind of having to awkwardly fumble around with this tennis ball.
The whole tennis ball thing sounds horrible. But what do you mean by a wand?
Well, it's just this it has almost like a small light bulb, really. It has kind of a stick at one end and a little orb at the top. Basically, as you go to hold it, in the orb at the top has the two sensors, and then you have just kind of a more slender cone down at the bottom that you can grab a hold of or mount onto a tripod mount or anything like that.
You can take 360 degree photos and videos. And is that all the camera does?
Well, it's also one of the first to allow 360-degree live streaming to Facebook and Google's YouTube service.
Okay.
Which is something that YouTube has had for a little while now, but Facebook has been trying really hard to implement in a way that doesn't suck down a whole lot of everyone's data. And so this is an attempt really at continuing Facebook's kind of journalism push, where they can give cameras to people who can kind of record live events as they're happening. In this 360-degree format, so that you're capturing everything instead of just the thing that's happening right in front of you.
Do you need to have a Samsung smartphone to work the Gear 360?
You need to have a Samsung phone to work with this if you are using Android, but it does also work with the iPhone. So it does not work with every Android phone, but it will work with most Samsung phones, all of the new Samsung phones, and it will work with almost every iPhone.
Okay. And I don't know. How much is it going to cost? What's it setting me back this time?
We haven't gotten a price for this yet. It's actually something that we're going to hear a little more about later this month. But the expectation is for it to be around $250 to $300, which is a little cheaper than what it was last year for the kind of the more awkward version of this. And that puts it pretty competitively with the other 360-degree cameras that are out there right now, which is good because it offers a little more as far as features.
Speaking of video and photography, Apple has a new video and photo editing app called Clips. What can you do with this? Why would it matter?
This ended up being a lot cuter than I thought it was going to be. And I got a little bit of a side eye from my colleague, Renee Ritchie, who spent a lot of time with it very recently, because it seemed like a very silly thing until I saw the things that it was capable of. But this is kind of a simple photo capture and editing tool where you can, record a bunch of different, clips of things and kind of stitch them together very quickly into a separate video. And there are a couple things that make it really interesting. The first is, kind of this live ability to add filters and stickers and kind of all of the things that are now a big part of the Apple ecosystem to kind of add your own personal flair to something in an almost Instagram-like fashion. But then it actually uses Siri to dictate whatever text it can understand from when you're speaking or when someone else is speaking. And it'll actually add live captioning and subtitles, or I'd say captioning, not subtitles, to whatever it is that you're recording at the time. And you can actually arrange that text in a bunch of different formats. So you can have it be kind of very professional looking down at the bottom of the screen, or you can have it be very artistic with, larger fonts that kind of pop up all over the screen and look very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you can make little nice, cool videos with text.
Yeah, it really is, it's a very simple, kind of straightforward app. It's very easy to use. It's available to anyone with an iPhone, and I found it very compelling, compared to just recording a quick video and posting it on Instagram, for example.
Is it free?
It is a free app.
Yay! Then I'll try it. I'm cheap. Russell Holly, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lynette, our All Sides interns Sarah Stacy and Kyle McKinnon, video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.